Welcome to Making Waves, independent voices for peace and justice, your local connection to the world on WSCA LP 106.1 FM, Portsmouth Community Radio. This is Amy Antonucci, and I'm happy to introduce our show to you today, August 26, 2006. Here's what we have coming up for you. In our first hour, following news, we feature the next segment of our Seabrook Anti-Nuclear Power Activism Retrospective with a Making Waves interview of Sam Lovejoy. In our second hour, we'll feature an interview with Ann Miller of New Hampshire Peace Action about her recent trip to Hiroshima, Japan, for a conference on the abolition of nuclear weapons. We'll end with Between the Lines, independent radio out of Bridgeport, Connecticut. We'll also have music, announcements, and more, so stay with us. First, for some news.
This is Steve Diamond with News You Need to Know. From Reuters, UN Secretary General Kofi Annan said an Israeli raid deep into Lebanon last Saturday violated the UN-backed truce and made him deeply concerned. A spokesman for Annan said, quote, "Secretary General is deeply concerned about a violation by the Israeli side of the cessation of hostilities as laid out in the Security Council Resolution 1701. Israel said the commando attack on a Hezbollah stronghold in eastern Lebanon was defensive and was designed to disrupt weapons supplies to Hezbollah from Syria and Iran. The statement said that according to UN peacekeepers in Lebanon, quote, "there have also been several air violations by Israeli military aircraft. All such violations of Security Council Resolution 1701 endanger the fragile calm that was reached after much negotiation and undermine the authority of the government of Lebanon." Israel denied it had violated the resolution, which allows it to act in self-defense. And from Agence France-Presse, UN says Lebanon's development annihilated. Lebanon's 15-year economic and social recovery from civil war was wiped out in the recent Israeli offensive against Hezbollah, the UN Development Agency said. Jean Faber, a spokesman for the UN Development Program, said, "The damage is such that the last 15 years of work on reconstruction and rehabilitation following the previous problems that Lebanon experienced are now annihilated. Lebanon's relatively healthy progress towards the United Nations Millennium Development Goals, which cover a range of social and economic targets, have been brought back to zero," he told journalists. Faber estimated that overall economic losses for Lebanon from the month-long conflict between Israel and Hezbollah totaled at least $15 billion, if not more. At least 5 Lebanese children were killed in recent days when they picked up unexploded munitions, and more than a dozen have been injured, UNICEF said. And from the AP and sfgate.com, Israeli helicopters and tanks move into Gaza. Published August 22nd. Israeli soldiers, backed by helicopter gunships, tanks, and armored personnel carriers, moved into Palestinian-controlled areas near the main Israel-Gaza cargo crossing on Tuesday, conducting house-to-house searches and arrests. 5 Palestinians were moderately wounded. 3 Palestinians were arrested. The military confirmed an operation near the Karni crossing, but wouldn't divulge its objectives. "It took 2 of my cousins and asked them about fighters, tunnels, and many other issues," said farmer Ahmed Helles, 65, whose olive trees were being uprooted by Israeli military bulldozers as part of the operation. Separately, in southern Gaza, the Israeli army moved into farmlands near the town of Khan Yunis, firing machine guns into the fields after calling on farmers to evacuate the area, Palestinian security officials said. Cameramen filming the operation said they came under fire but were not wounded. The army had no immediate comment. And next, we have a few related headlines only. From the Jerusalem Post, Israel may go it alone and attack Iran. From Agence France-Presse, Israel defiant on Lebanon raid, prepares for next round. And from Haaretz, senior IDF officials say Hezbollah hostilities liable to restart soon. From the BBC News, Iran boosted by war on terror. Iran's influence in the Middle East has been heightened by the U.S. war on terror, according to a report. The London-based Chatham House think tank study said the U.S. had eliminated regimes in Iraq and Afghanistan, but failed to replace them with stable political structures. Recent conflicts involving Israel in Lebanon and Gaza have added instability, the report continued. Iran now superseded the U.S. as the most influential power in the Middle East, it concluded. and from Deutsche Presse Agentur. As many as 42 people were killed in Afghan violence, including at least 11 suspected Taliban members killed in an airstrike, while another 18 militants were killed in a fight with Afghan police in the south. One Afghan army soldier was killed and four others were wounded Tuesday when their convoy was ambushed by suspected militants in the Kakhmaran district of southern province of Zabul, the Afghan defense ministry said in a statement. Meanwhile, a Canadian soldier died of injuries received in a suicide bombing in Kandahar City. The soldier was one of four NATO troops who were hurt on Tuesday in the car bombing of their military convoy. Attacks on NATO and Afghan forces have been increasing since the alliance took command of security for six southern provinces from the U.S.-led military coalition in late July. And from the New York Times, reported on August 24th, Afghan says U.S. forces killed eight civilians. Eight civilians, including a child, were killed in an operation by American forces in eastern Afghanistan, an Afghan police official said. United States forces admitted killing a 12-year-old boy and injuring a woman, but said the seven men also killed were Qaeda facilitators, who had opened fire on them as they approached a housing compound. The Afghan government has sent a team to investigate the circumstances of the killings, said the deputy police chief of Kunar, the province where the incident took place. He said the men killed were elders who had gathered in the house to resolve a family dispute. Four other civilians were arrested in the raid, he said. The operation took place north of the provincial capital, Assadabad, where soldiers of the 10th Mountain Division and the Afghan National Army are based. They frequently clash with insurgents opposed to the government and the presence of foreign troops in the mountainous border province. The incident follows another last week in Paktika province, where coalition planes bombed two vehicles belonging to the Afghan border police, killing 14 members of a border patrol. Colonel Collins insisted the vehicles were driven by militants. And from the Washington Times, innocent children jailed, U.S. official says. Reported on August 19th. Children who have never been charged with a crime are being held in juvenile prisons in Iraq, a State Department official stated in a report he posted on the Internet. Marshall Adam, an official with the National Coordination Team based out of Camp Victory in Iraq, said, "These are not hardened criminals or terrorists." He added that there had been reports of physical and other abuse in the detention centers, but that the U.S.-led coalition considered the issue, quote, "not our urgent business." Called at home while on vacation in the United States, Mr. Adams said he went ahead and published his report because he wanted it to be part of the public record. He added, "I'm not talking about those arrested or captured in the process of fighting against the coalition. I'm talking about children who were rounded up for no particular reason, who have not been charged, but have been put into detention." And from the Christian Science Monitor, U.S. Marine call-up signals a long war. With the global war on terrorism in Afghanistan and Iraq now well into its fourth year, the strain is starting to show on U.S. troop levels. The Marine Corps announced this week that it will involuntarily activate 2,500 reservists. Briefing reporters Tuesday, Colonel Guy Stratton, head of Marine Corps Manpower Mobilization, acknowledged that, quote, "this is going to be a long war," and that there is clearly a need for more Marines in Iraq and Afghanistan. In essence, Colonel Stratton said, "There have not been enough volunteers among those in the individual ready reserve, Marines who served 4 years on active duty but are eligible for recall for the next 4 years." The Marine Corps call-up follows a pattern in military manpower in recent years. Some of those in uniform are on their second or third deployment to the war zones. From time to time, the Army has had to recruit more soldiers from the lowest acceptable category based on test scores, education levels, personal background, and other indicators of ability. Some military recruiters, always under pressure to produce, have been reprimanded for illegally inducing clearly unqualified young men and women into signing up. Citizen soldiers in the National Guard have played an extraordinarily large role on the ground in combat areas. To some experts, the call-up of Marine Corps reservists indicates that the war is likely to last longer and be more hard-fought than earlier official predictions. Retired Air Force Colonel Sam Gardner said, "The most significant dimension of this, to me, is that it says there are no longer any rosy assessments about how things are going in Iraq and Afghanistan." The Army, too, is said to mobilize several thousand soldiers from its ready reserves. It has also issued stop-loss orders for several thousand troops, extending their tours in Iraq. And finally, from the Washington Post, Bush's new Iraq argument: it could be worse. Of all the words that President Bush used at his news conference this week to defend his policies in Iraq, the one that did not pass his lips was progress. For 3 years, the president tried to reassure Americans that more progress was being made in Iraq than they realized. But with Iraq either in civil war or on the brink of it, Bush dropped the unseen progress argument in favor of the contention that things could be even worse. The shifting rhetoric reflected a broader pessimism that has reached into even some of the most optimistic corners of the administration, a sense that the Iraq venture has taken a dark turn and will not be resolved anytime soon. Bush advisers once believed that if they met certain benchmarks, such as building a constitutional democracy and training a new Iraqi army, the war would be won. Now they believe they have more or less met those goals, yet the war rages on. While still committed to the venture, officials have privately told friends and associates outside government that they have grown discouraged in recent months. Even the death of al-Qaeda's leader in Iraq proved not to be the turning point they expected, they have told associates, and other developments have been relentlessly dispiriting, with fewer signs of hope. Bush acknowledged this week that he had been discouraged as well. He said, quote, "Frustrated? Sometimes I'm frustrated. Rarely surprised. Sometimes I'm happy. But war is not a time of joy. These aren't joyous times. These are challenging times, and they're difficult times, and they're straining the psyche of our country." With sectarian violence flaring into some of the worst bloodshed since the March 2003 invasion, the White House felt the need to connect with the anxiety in the American public.
Last month, we kicked off 9 months of Clamshell Alliance member interviews. For our Making Waves Seabrook Anti-Nuclear Power Activism Retrospective. Between August 2006, with a 30-year anniversary of the first civil disobedience action at Seabrook, and April 2007, with the 30-year anniversary of the 1,414 arrests at the Seabrook Station site, we will run an interview every last Saturday of the month with a Clamshell Alliance member. Over these months, we hope to bring out the rich history of nonviolent direct action here in the seacoast of New Hampshire, and we aim to bring out current issues about nuclear power and its revival. Here's Damon Thomas interviewing Sam Lovejoy.
I want to welcome our listeners to another interview segment here today on Making Waves. I'm Damon Thomas. I'm your host for this portion of the show. In the coming weeks and months, Making Waves will feature talks and interviews with numerous people involved both then and now in the battle over the Seabrook Nuclear Power Plant as part of a retrospective commemorating what is now the 30th anniversary of the first occupations of the Seabrook Station site. The protests which accompanied the start of construction of the nuclear plant in the mid to late 70s were pivotal events in the birth and emergence of the growing anti-nuclear movement. But prior to Seabrook, other persons were active in other ways to bring about public awareness to the hazards of nuclear power and to lay the groundwork for the growing anti-nuclear movement that was to follow. One of those persons was Sam Lovejoy of Montague, Mass., who joins us today on Making Waves. Sam, thanks for taking the time to be with us, and welcome to Making Waves.
Absolutely, and no nukes.
Sam, okay, some brief history. In 1974, you toppled a weather tower constructed by Northeast Utilities, and that tower was erected by the utility as a precursor to the proposed construction of two nuclear power plants in Montague. Could you fill us in, if you would, on what happened, on the details, you know, why you chose a tower, what led you to take this action, and, you know, what did it represent? Because it certainly helped to kickstart the anti-nuclear movement in New England, if not the country.
In the fall of 1973, Northeast Utilities was hinting that they were going to build a large power plant in western Massachusetts in Franklin County. Montague is approximately a mile and a half from where I was living. It was right next to the Connecticut River on 2,000 acres of gorgeous land, and the power lines were close by. It was an ideal site for a power plant, and what we discovered was that on building the 500-foot meteorological tower, they said it was to test weather conditions to see if the power plant was well-sited, when that was utter baloney. What was really happening was that they were using it also to design the evacuation plans for a nuclear plant. And the utilities would deny that, but we found that out digging through federal documents. So from the fall until the spring of 73 to 74, we tried to get a movement off the ground against the nuclear power plants, and basically the people in the town hall were all bought off. Most of the officialdom in the Western Mass is all bought off, sometimes directly, sometimes indirectly, but they all fell for the electricity too cheap to meter, the safest power plants in the world. And we were learning that they were unsafe, environmentally unsafe, radioactively unsafe, that they were the opposite of too cheap to meter. They were too expensive to hang a meter off of them. Generally speaking, it was a huge environmental, radiological, health, and economic disaster. By the time George Washington's birthday rolled around in February 22nd of 1974, I decided that I would walk out onto the plains where they were locating the power plant and undo the turnbuckles that held the 500-foot tower up. They had big 500-foot guy wires that stabilized the tower. And I undid four of them over the course of an hour or two, and the thing came crashing down, and I walked down to the police station, turned myself into the police, and said that this was an act of civil disobedience. And boy, that did shock the crowd. A lot of things changed in Montague and Franklin County real fast. The national media picked up on it, and suddenly they realized that there was a stronger statement than just going to court, which every single court case had lost, hands down. What basically happened was that the liberal anti-nuke people that were raising money and doing court actions and raising technical issues were always looked at as radical crazies. And the moment Sam knocked over the tower, suddenly I became the radical crazy, and all the people that were opposed to nuclear power on a regulatory basis, the liberal folks, all got enormous credibility. They were all interviewed immediately, and suddenly this issue got a spotlight nationally, internationally. Over the course of the next 7 months, I prepared for a felony trial, a five-year felony, destruction of property. I set up a trial in the middle of September where I defended myself, and I had two very fine experts, one on civil disobedience. Howard Zinn came and spoke to the court, and John Goffman, who was an expert on radiological problems and was an anti-nuclear scientist, and he came and spoke to the court. And after a nine-day trial, the judge threw the case out of court, found me not guilty, and life moved on. Between February and September, I would say that I did, hundreds of interviews, tons of newspaper articles, television. What happened was there was a great deal of energy in the country looking to figure out how to confront nuclear plants in a way that was safe, because, of course, you don't want to get near an operating nuclear plant. You certainly wouldn't want to tamper with one. But the ones proposed to be built, the idea was to stop them in their tracks, get a movement going so that they could never start the construction. And, of course, the next step was Seabrook.
Sam, let's consider where we were in 1974. I mean, at that point in our history, the United States was still very much at war in Vietnam. There was a concern in the minds of many folks. And the anti-nuclear movement at that time seemed to be in a beginning stage of sorts. I don't know that there was a widespread consciousness in terms of people's awareness of the hazards that nuclear power could pose. And it seemed to me that that was one of the uphill battles you may have been facing at that time. And I'm wondering if you could just address that.
The federal government had been promoting and offering financial incentives to the utilities to build nuclear plants. They were a job creation thing. And in the early 70s, of course, we had the energy crisis when there was the oil embargo, and maybe some people don't remember that, but the price of oil went up dramatically, and there were long gas lines, and there was a big freakout. One of the things that was sort of wonderful, though, in the early 70s was, as the war was winding down, Watergate happened. And suddenly the credibility of federal officials, the President of the United States and all the jerks that worked around him, suddenly had no credibility at all. And people at least had the idea that you could be skeptical about some things that came out of the Fed's mouth. And the utilities weren't far behind. So when someone tells you that something is too cheap to meter, I mean, well, then get rid of the meters and maybe we'll believe you. But the meters never came down, and that's because the nuclear plants turned out to be unalterably expensive. Also, I think people ought to realize the irony that in 1970, it was Richard Nixon, the lunatic, who passed the National Environmental Policy Act. And the first Earth Day was in 1970. That was the beginning of any environmental consciousness, well, environmental legislation that would lead to consciousness. There were people who were very aware of the environment, you know, Rachel Carson, the Sierra Club existed, all those organizations. But it wasn't until the early 70s that there was an organizational awareness where lots of groups came along. Also, in 1974, we were faced with this odd situation where the people who had been fighting the war heavily for years graduated from college, had to get jobs, moved on to grad school, had to get lives, moved to, you know, move out of the parents' home and get their own lives together. And that's the same thing that happened to me and the people that lived on the communal farm with me. So oddly enough, when they announced a nuclear plant for the town of Montague, it was the nuclear issue that came to us. We didn't seek out nuclear power as the issue. We wanted to protect our local communities. It was one of our fundamental principles that we had been involved with when organizing against the war and civil rights. And civil rights is a local issue. It's not an international. I mean, it's both. But if you can't cure it locally, then you got no cure. So the nuclear plant came to us. We didn't go to nuclear power. After the trial in 1974, a lot of people would call me up and say, hey, can you come speak? And I spent a lot of time in New Hampshire, and the reason I was spending so much time in New Hampshire was because the Seabrook nuclear plant had been announced and was going through all its licensing phases. It had not started being built yet. They owned the site, but they hadn't gotten their license to start. So every time I would speak in New Hampshire, I hardly met a person in New Hampshire that didn't believe that Seabrook would be the first nuclear plant that the license would be turned down. And I don't blame them. It was one of the worst sightings I ever saw in my life for two huge reasons. Environmental reasons related to the amount of hot water that they were proposing to pump into Seabrook Bay, which would kill all the clams, all the wildlife. I mean, just forget it. They're talking about 30 degrees warmer than the background water. They're going to pump it directly into the bay. The second thing is that Seabrook is a huge vacation spot. And the evacuation planning for Seabrook thought that they could remove 250,000 beachgoers in something like an hour and a half. And anybody that's been to Seabrook or the Seacoast knows that you're not moving the traffic. If there was an accident on a nice sunny day in the summer, forget it. So I can't blame the local people, but I would always say, you got to be prepared. You got to be prepared. And most people would say, yeah, we're prepared and we got phone trees and this and that, but it's not going to happen. And the first week in July, I think it was actually the last day of June or whatever, of 1976, the utilities and the media went crazy saying Seabrook has been granted a license to proceed with building. And the utilities started, you know, raping the site immediately. They were in there the next day with bulldozers tearing down trees and everything. It was also interesting for Seabrook because the majority of the town's people in Seabrook had voted against the nuclear plant. And so it became a wonderful local issue of local control for the citizens of New Hampshire to say, we believe in local control. Seabrook voted against it. What does that mean? And, of course, you had probably one of the craziest governors ever elected in the United States history, Meldrum Thompson. He was the lunatic as governor who petitioned the federal government to have the New Hampshire National Guard trained in launching nuclear weapons because he was afraid that Russia was going to invade the east coast of the United States. This is the truth.
Yeah, that's a story not many folks probably know about, but that was the one that got circulated a few years later, apparently.
So anyway, I got, I don't know how many phone calls. I mean, you know, 20, 50 phone calls all in the same day saying, Sam, what do we do now? You know, and a lot of them knew what had to be done, but I said, well, get your phone tree together. I'll call some people, and let's just have a real quick gathering of 12, 15 people to sort of figure out how to organize quickly. And so that meeting was put together, I think, only in like 2 or 3 days. We met, I'm not sure where it was, I think in Hampton Beach in the middle of the summer. So it must have been July 1st, 2nd, 3rd. On someone's lawn, and we basically planned how to get together a meeting to organize something.
Well, I think your memory is accurate. August 1st, 1976 was the anniversary of the first occupation of the Seabrook site when 18 people walked onto the site and were arrested, followed 3 weeks later on August 22nd by 180 people who occupied the site.
What I was trying to do was get to those occupations and how fast this organization fell together and how wonderful it was. I mean, a lot of people have asked me, what do you think was the most wonderful part of Seabrook? And I think what I personally believe is that from that meeting of 10 or 12 people put together in a day or two, We then came up with a list of names of people who should be invited, and I think there was like 25 people who came together, I believe it was on a Saturday or Sunday. We got there early. We met for 12 or 14 hours. During that meeting, everybody was cooperative, and we came up with all the basic principles of what became the Clamshell Alliance. Number one, paramount local control. It was the Seacoast and Seabrook people who got to decide whether some idea that someone else came up with that might sound good simply wasn't applicable to the local area. Number two, consensus decision making, with, in essence, a kind of deferral or almost a blackball granted to the Seacoast and Seabrook organizers. But consensus control, opposition to nuclear power only. Anybody that had other politics are more than welcome to come, but they had to understand that nuclear power was the issue that we were confronting in Seabrook, and we're not there to promote any other agenda. A lot of agendas made sense. If you were environmentally conscious, you understood that nuclear power was a special kind of environmental issue, but there are other issues. But you could have been anti-war, you could be pro-abortion, you could be anti-abortion. We asked people to come and talk about their issues with their fellows. But that was one-on-one contact. The issue we wanted was just plain Seabrook. And one cute thing here is that we suddenly realized we had to break up into little groups. It's sort of, you know, what kind of committee should there be? Should we have an occupation right away? Occupation was the first decision. We had to go through all these things. And one of the things was, what is the name? And so four or five people spun off and had this little group, and they started talking about names. They bat around names for an hour or two, and they came back to us, and they said, Clamshell Alliance. And I think everybody else in the meeting looked at them like, what, are you crazy? Explain yourself. People are laughing. And first it was a Clam Alliance, and then a Clamshell Alliance. And the whole idea here was the shell held the contents of the clam. And it was us as a group. We were sort of trying to be the contents of an anti-nuclear movement. So it wasn't the Clam Alliance, it was the Clamshell Alliance. And they explained it, and everybody was laughing. And on the other hand, there's nothing like a little humor to inspire people as well. I mean, it was just like, there was never a time when someone couldn't come up with a joke that was simply brought people together. And nonviolent civil disobedience was the clear consensus. So then the design was, how do we move forward? We've come up with consensus decision making, nonviolent direct action, people had to be trained before they could be arrested, and that we would try and occupy the site. So the idea was that only people from the Seacoast would be involved with the first group, and how many could we get? We didn't care how many. We just wanted to know how many could be trained and show up as quickly as possible. So August 1 was picked as the date. It was only 3 weeks away from the first huge organizing meeting that got Clamshell Alliance going in New Hampshire and around New England. 18 people were trained and ready to be arrested, and so 18 people got arrested. We then made a commitment to see if we could get 180 people and scare everybody by saying, you know, the utilities in particular, that we're going to escalate by a factor of 10 for each occupation. So the next set of people were only from New Hampshire. And then we were telling people, and the next occupation will be a minimum of 1,800 people. We'll get them all organized. And the moment we get them organized, we're going to bring them in, and they're going to occupy the site. And then the next time it would be throughout the United States, and we hope to get at least 18,000 people there. So, of course, the cops didn't think that we could ever pull off 18, and 18 got arrested. And then 3 weeks later, 180 got arrested, and then they said, wow, these people are serious. Plus, they've got feelers out all over New England. And so the huge arrests. We didn't get 1,800. Didn't really bother us. I think we got 1,414, or that was the number that, you know, they kept admitting, and they didn't know what to do with them. And that was in April of 1977. So they locked him up in five armories. I could probably tell stories to you forever here, so maybe you ought to ask me a question.
Well, getting back to the Montague proposed nuclear plants, as well as Seabrook Units 1 and 2, Montague units were never built, and Seabrook Unit 2 never came online as well. Did you detect a change in public sentiment or opinion regarding nuclear power between the time when you took the first action in 1974 and maybe certainly by decade's end?
Absolutely. I think something had to happen in the national mind that got people to say, the feds have been promoting this. The utilities, these large corporations have been promoting this with all the bull wrapped in there, like the electricity too cheap to meter and the safest thing that ever happened and blah, 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 blah. And the moment that the national psyche realized that there are people who oppose it, it made them at least say, I wonder why. There were enough nuclear plants around the United States and around the world, and you'd be surprised how many tiny accidents, little things that go wrong, where they would have to shut down the plant, a water leak, a fire, a this or that. And buried in the, you know, back pages of every newspaper in the country would be these little articles. And when I travel around New England and the United States and say to people, you don't have to believe anything I say. I just want you to read your local newspaper, read some of the literature, ask some questions, and I can't tell you how many hundreds of postcards I would get from people saying, you know, it's true, on page 19 at the very bottom, a little filler thing was talking about a nuclear plant accident in Browns Ferry, you know, Alabama, and there was a fire down there and they had to shut the plant and it was ended up being shut for a year and, you know, it cost billions and trillions of dollars and wow, I never realized how vulnerable they are.
Just stepping back for a sec, what were the basis of your objections to nuclear power? Because some of the, I'm told that many of the main objections then are still valid today.
Well, generally speaking, all nuclear plants give off radiation. The feds have a regulation that says that a certain amount is quote-unquote safe. They have a hard time bringing themselves to admit that no level of radiation is safe. Of course, you couldn't build a nuclear plant if you didn't have a regulation that said that a certain amount was safe, and so they've come up with numbers. So first you've got the fear of low-level radiation for people who live in the local area. The second problem is that they cannot say that there will not be a nuclear accident within a nuclear plant. They can say that the odds are low, but the trouble is they're highly complicated equipment being run by human beings. Anything can go wrong, and as, of course, this was after Seabrook, but Three Mile Island happened, and that was not supposed to happen. It was partial meltdown of a nuclear plant that almost killed thousands upon thousands of people in Pennsylvania. So you have the safety of nuclear power, low-level radiation, and the health effects of that, genetic defects, cancers, etc. Then you have the safety question related to the operation of a nuclear plant. Then you have the cost of nuclear power. When you talk about cost, the Montague nuclear plant was announced to cost $1.35 billion when it was announced in 1973. When they stopped planning for it in 1977, when they conceded that Montague would not be the site of a nuclear power plant, the cost was $14 billion. It had gone up in price in 3 years, a factor of 10. Now, don't forget with Seabrook. Public Service Company in New Hampshire went bankrupt. A lot of money, a lot of people lost their shirts. A lot of investors, a lot of people with little retirement funds who bought shares in Public Service Company in New Hampshire, et cetera, et cetera. But let me tell you, one Seabrook nuclear power plant bankrupted the biggest utility in New Hampshire, who basically had the incredibly good reputation in New Hampshire until they decided to build a nuclear plant. Then they collapsed and died. They were bought out by all the big guys. So you've got cost, you've got safety, and you've got the fear of low-level radiation. And then finally, there is no answer to what to do with nuclear waste. And the federal government, in other words, taxpayers, pay for the promotion of nuclear power, the design of nuclear plants, huge financial incentives, and then finally, the federal government agrees to take all the cost of storing nuclear waste, which is produced by these plants. Now, you know, what industry has ever been told, you make money on the production, and we'll take all the loss for any of the garbage that's produced? It's the most phenomenal ripoff of the American taxpayer I've ever seen.
You're listening to Making Waves on Portsmouth Community Radio. I'm Damon Thomas, and my guest is Sam Lovejoy, one of the grandfathers of the anti-nuclear power movement in the country. Sam, what lessons can you share with our listeners about citizen involvement as a result of your efforts in the anti-nuclear movement. What lessons did you learn about citizen involvement? I mean, the point being that when you toppled the tower in 1974, you were one person. And yet, a number of groups throughout New England and throughout the country, certainly the Clamshaw Alliance in Western Massachusetts, you had the Alternative Energy Coalition, which I always loved as a play on words because the Alternative Energy Coalition's name is actually the AEC, or acronym is the AEC, which is the same as the Atomic Energy Commission, which was, we know, was once the federal agency charged with supposedly the regulation of nuclear power, though it was most often aligned with promoting nuclear power, promoting the very industry it was intended to regulate. So I thought that was an interesting play on words. But all these organizations blossomed after 1974. I'm inclined to say that speaks volumes to the power that one person can have. And I'm wondering if you could just address the issue of citizen involvement in nuclear power as well as other issues that face us as a society.
Well, that's a really good question. I think there's so many aspects to that question, and I'd go back to Seabrook and Clamshell Alliance in particular. I said before, and I'll say again, a good sense of humor is critically important. Number two, you need to educate yourself. Number three, I do believe that the Clamshell Alliance organizing model became accepted and adopted all around the country. Within a matter of 6 months to a year, there were over 40 nonviolent direct action groups set up to oppose nuclear plants in their local areas around the United States. Now, one of the reasons for that is that it was determined that local control was critically important. Number two, that nonviolent direct action, civil disobedience, in other words, taking responsibility for the actions that you do enter into, like occupation of a nuclear plant site, means that you're going to be charged with trespassing, and that you're willing to serve that time if you're found guilty. What's funny is that so many of us are found not guilty because they wanted to throw us out of the courthouse because they didn't want to stuff up the jails. They didn't want us organizing in the jails. But a base of education is critically important, and of course, nuclear power, there had been no education throughout the United States about anything other than too cheap to meter. And people started to realize that as they read up that there were real issues. So education is crucial. Number two, a determination to take a course of action which is not violent. And the best way to say that, sort of a corollary to that, is to have a sense of humor. I can't tell you how many times someone would say something and everybody would laugh. This was actually fun organizing. We were deadly serious about stopping the Seabrook nuclear power plant. But there was never a time when people couldn't laugh about something. During anti-war days, the anti-war movement got more and more and more and more serious. And I do believe it lost its sense of humor and, in a sense, lost its way. Because it's local people who really make decisions about local issues. And a nuclear plant is a local issue. It has national aspects. Now, a war is just the opposite, and it raises all sorts of tricky organizing questions because you have to be able to talk to your next door neighbor, but not about the nuclear plant they're building 3 miles down the road or 12 miles down the road, but a war that's happening on the other side of the world. But maintaining a sense of humor at all times is critically important because it's the sort of the honesty and love that comes out of the demonstrators that neutralizes the police state, that neutralizes police officers, neutralizes district attorneys, neutralizes judges. And it also wins the hearts and minds of local people. Those local people end up spreading across the state of New Hampshire, pretty soon New England, pretty soon the country, pretty soon the world. So in terms of organizing, education is number one. Number two, to be nonviolent in all your activities, to threaten nobody, and to adopt a strategy that you believe will communicate to local people, and I mean local people, meaning people who oppose you as well as people who support you. And the support that came out of New Hampshire because of our nonviolent strategy was phenomenal. We had the wives of judges calling us, telling us stuff. We had people in the National Guard warning us about what the governor was doing. We had people in a DA's office calling us up saying, watch out for this guy, and this guy's cool, and watch out for that person. And people in the state police and local police, I can't tell you the phenomenal amount of support we got from people you would never, never guess would be helping us. We had a person in the executive branch of the state of New Hampshire who would report to one of our members on almost a daily basis. So we had background on the kinds of tactical maneuvers the state was doing. And within the utilities, we had so many people who worked for the utilities who thought Tallman was short. And I'm saying that in a funny way, that the utilities were making a mistake. And so you got to have love in your heart. You got to have an educational base, and you got to be willing to take on a tactic that might take time, as opposed to a tactic that you think is going to solve everything right away. As far as Montague, the economy basically destroyed the Montague nuclear plant. There was no need for the nuclear plant. The cost was phenomenal, and we got a local educational base going so broadly, so quickly, that there was an election held in November of 1974, and we put a ballot question on. 47% of the people who voted against the Montague nuclear power plant in the county that we lived in, or slightly bigger because it was a congressional district, voted against the plant, and we had about a year to educate those voters, as opposed to the federal government and the utilities having zillions of dollars and several decades of promoting their idea. And why is it that in less than a year there was this groundswell? And the same thing is happening today with the Iraq war, you know, with all the baloney and all the manipulation and all the lies and all the oil company executives and all the manipulation again. People are starting to get the idea that maybe that war in Iraq was for some other reason, you know, like oil, power trips, imperialism, whatever you want to say. But down and dirty, American soldiers are being killed, and probably by a factor of 10 or 20, Iraqi civilians are dying in droves. For what? We have to take responsibility for everything we do, whether it's the supporting of nuclear power as an idea, whether it's supporting Saddam Hussein, or whether we finally got our brains about it and decided that apartheid in South Africa was bad. There's a movement that took years and years and years and years and years to get going, and finally Nelson Mandela was let out of jail after 27 years. There's a determined guy. And what did he become? The president of South Africa. So, yes, you got to be willing to accept the long haul. You got to educate yourself constantly. You have to absolutely adopt the principle of nonviolence and work with your fellows. And consensus is also a critical factor in decision making. Democracy has this inbred problem. I actually heard it said to me a different way from an Indian, but I'll tell you that story in one second. If you have a vote and 100 million people vote and 51 million people vote one way and 49 million vote the other way, what happens to those 49 million people? They just have to shut up? No, they don't stop thinking. In other words, the idea of consensus, meaning that everybody is brought along, is critical. Now, this Indian guy was telling me this story about the three-legged pot. And he said it to me. I looked at him like, what kind of parable is this? And he says to me, democracy is totally idiotic. Look at it as a three-legged pot, Sam. He says, you take a lot of water, you put it in the pot to make a stew, you put the pot on the fire. Now, you got three guys, and they have a meeting over an issue. And he said, and the vote is unanimous. The pot stands up. What happens if it's two people one way and one person the other? Then you got a two-legged pot, and you know what? They tip over and not only spill the contents of the pot, they put out the fire.
Perfect analogy. You know, I'm wondering, as we sort of wrap up this segment here, if there's any other parting thoughts or points you'd like to make to our listening audience.
There's so many funny stories that I want to tell you. One comes to mind right now that I'll never forget. It was directly involved me. So we're having an organizing meeting of the coordinating committee of the clamshell, and it's, I don't know, August 3rd or 4th or something. We've got 18 people that have been arrested, and they're being processed in the local court. And we've got one person running back and forth to our meeting saying, well, what's happening to him? Because we wanted each of our 18 people to stand up and say, I plead not guilty, and the reason is, and give a statement. And we kept getting these reports back that the judge was saying, and it was just the odds that there were, I think, 14 men and 4 women. I'm not positive what the makeup of the crew was, but there were more men than women from the seacoast. And we kept getting these reports that the one man would get up and the judge would tell him to shut up or be found in contempt and send him on his way. And then the second guy and the third guy and the fourth guy. And finally, it was like after 8 or 9 of these processes, the first woman was called forward. And the woman was asked how she pleaded, and she said, I can't tell you how I plead until I make the following statement. And the judge was so dumbfounded that he allowed her to carry on for about 10 minutes. And, of course, we had all the press. We're at the courthouse because that's the theater of being arrested. So we pulled it off. Now, one of the people that was at the coordinating committee was this woman, Elizabeth Boardman, and she was the head of one of the co-heads of New England American Friends Service Committee, and she was critically important in helping us get trainers for nonviolent action and to break up into affinity groups and have like little groups that could rely on each other for each of the little arrests. And Elizabeth was standing right next to me, and we were all stretching when this report came in that the first person to be able to make a statement was a woman. And so here's Elizabeth. She's in her mid-70s. I'm like whatever I am, 30 years old. And I started cheering, and I said, let's hear it for sexism. And Elizabeth punched me in the solar plexus. And everybody was standing there looking. And she said, we're all here for nuclear power, but don't forget, Sam, I'm still a woman, and I'm not hearing it for sexism. And then she burst out laughing, at which point the whole coordinating committee couldn't stop laughing. This nonviolent woman had just popped me in the chest. It was just so funny. None of us could have. Oh, my God, it was the greatest. Another little thing that happened that was sort of funny was I grew up on a farm, and everybody was headed off for the occupation of the 180 for the New Hampshire people. And I stopped at an agricultural store. I can't remember, Agway or someplace. And I bought 50 pounds of corn seed. We'll do this again, I said, but wherever you land, I said, just dig a little hole, throw some seeds in there, and everybody put corn seeds in their pocket. And weeks later, I said to someone, hey, is there any reports about corn coming up? And, you know, we had gotten corn plants planted all over the place, and the poor utility workers had to go out there and pull up the corn because it was an indicator of the occupation.
Leaving your mark one way or the other. Sam, thanks again for your time and sharing with our listening audience your experiences. And reminding our listeners that you are listening to Making Waves on Portsmouth Community Radio. I'm Damon Thomas. My guest has been Sam Lovejoy. And Amy, back to you.
I have lived all my life in this country. I love every flower and tree. I expect to live here till I'm 90. It's the nukes that must go and not me. It's the nukes that must go and not me, my friends. The nukes that must go and not me. I expect to live here till I'm 90. It's the nukes that must go and not me. I've swallowed enough radiation. It's time I was standing my ground. So I'm joining that grand occupation. We're shutting that power plant down. We're shutting that power plant down, my friends. We're shutting that power plant down. I'm joining that grand occupation. We're shutting that power plant down. Seabrook, New Hampshire's a swell town. It's there that we're taking our stand. Why sit home and wait for a meltdown? Come fight for your freedom and land. Come fight for your freedom and land, my friends. Come fight for your freedom and land. Why sit home and wait for a meltdown? Come fight for your freedom and land. Thank you. the PSC shams. So let's sing of our happy condition, surrounded by acres of clams. Surrounded by acres of clams, my friends, surrounded by acres of clams. So let's sing of our happy condition, surrounded by acres of clams.
That was Charlie King with Acres of Clams. Join us again for the last Saturday in September for our next segment of our Making Waves Seabrook Anti-Nuclear Power Activism Retrospective.
To hear our previous shows, please visit our archive online at www.freewebs.com/sprav/audio.htm. Please email nhmakingwaves@yahoo.com and let us know what you think of our show. And feel free to call the station in the next hour for more information, 430-9722.